Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph. Peter Moore, the beeps and the static you were listening to a moment ago might have seemed prosaic enough, but in reality they marked one of the greatest achievements of the 20th century. You were listening to the signal that was transmitted back to Earth by the Soviet satellite Sputnik 1 on the 4th of October 1957. Sputnik's entry into orbit heralded the start of the space age and the start of a new era in our changing relationship with the night sky. Throughout human history, this relationship has shifted. For scientists, the night sky has been a puzzle. For voyagers, it has served as a map. For people of many religions, it has existed as a source of awe and solace. Perhaps the artist Vincent van Gogh described it best when he wrote that he felt a tremendous need to go out at night to paint the stars. The night sky and our human relationship with it is a subject that today's guest has long pondered. Stuart Clarke is an astronomer and a science writer. He writes for The Guardian, New Statesman, and has produced documentaries like Music of the Spheres for BBC Radio. His new book, Beneath the Night, has recently been published, and it traces our relationship with the stars from prehistoric caves to the space shuttle age. To be in with a chance of winning a copy of this book, just keep listening. In this whole vast story, it's the sound of those beeps from Sputnik 1 that mark one of the most important moments. Here is Stuart telling me much more about that history on a travel back through time. I'm going to start off by saying, Stuart Clarke, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. It's a conversation to really look forward to this because it's such an exciting evergreen topic, yours, Beneath the Night, which is the book that you've written, which we're going to structure our conversation around today. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much. I loved writing it and just pulling together so much of my personal history and also just looking back at culture, society, art and science and just seeing how it's indelibly sort of imprinted with the night sky and references to it.
Absolutely. I wanted to start with a quote from the 18th century, which is from, I imagine it's from The Spectator, it's by Joseph Addison anyway, and he says, "When we survey the whole Earth at once and the several planets that lie within its neighbourhood, we are filled with a pleasing astonishment to see so many worlds hanging one above another and sliding around their axles in such amazing pomp and solemnity," which is a very lucid, eloquent way of putting this picture of the solar system together in a paragraph. It's a longer quote than that, but I thought I'd start with it because it captures something of the feeling of awe which permeates your book. So whatever your whatever kind of theatre of history you're looking at, whether it's religion or science or poetry, I think it's that feeling which unites it all together. And I thought I'd get you to begin this conversation maybe by telling us a little bit about an anecdote that you describe later on in the book when you're in Sliding Spring Mountain and you have a moment looking up at the sky.
Yes, it was quite extraordinary because I was a graduate student at that point. And this was the first time that I had been to Australia to use one of the very biggest telescopes in the world at that time. And it was just extraordinary that I was standing there and I looked up at the night sky. And this was my first time deep into the Southern Hemisphere. And just by a cosmic coincidence, the Northern Hemisphere points away from the center of the galaxy, but the Southern Hemisphere points towards the center of the galaxy. So there's just so many more stars that you can see in the southern night sky. And it was a beautiful, beautiful night. I mean, that's why the telescopes were there. It's hardly any light pollution there, absolutely pitch black. And the stars were so vibrant. I mean, extraordinarily so. There was a couple of things that happened. One was a sort of an intellectual thing, which was that this is how most people who have lived, have seen the night sky, in ages past. This is the kind of level of detail and brightness at which they would have seen the night sky. And it brought it very close to you. And this was the other strange thing that happened, is I had this feeling that the stars were so close. It was almost like they were sort of luminous, ripe fruit just hanging there in the sky. And I almost had this feeling of wanting to reach up and pluck one from the sky, hold it. I felt they were so close, I could touch them. And holding those two concepts in my head, this idea that the stars are extremely far away, distant suns, just viewed from extreme distance, and yet feeling that I could touch them, was a profoundly strange moment. And I think that's the first time I truly experienced what I'd now recognize as awe, and the sort of a feeling of what Kant might call the cosmic sublime, this idea of just being immersed in this wide, vast, beautiful universe.
It's an episode that you relate that really resonated with me as well, because I was in the South Island of New Zealand, but in the northern part of it. It's called Queen Charlotte Sound, a beautiful part of the world, where again the kind of similarity is that there's very little light pollution. I suppose we're, kind of live in a very polluted light area in Europe, and especially in London, when you don't see much else than a 747 going ahead. But that sense of kind of having a moment under the night sky was really quite striking. And it made me think, actually, that we often talk about our age as a time of loss of nature, that we're living through an extinction era, etc. But one of the great losses of our human experience is probably that connection with the night sky. Would you say that's a fair point?
Yes, I think that is a fair point, but I would caveat it, and that is that I think that our relationship with the night sky has changed constantly throughout history. And whilst we might not be so aware of being beneath the night, as it were, now with our tendency for urban living, we still maintain an extremely strong connection to the night sky and the wider universe. And that's through the imagery and the information that's coming back from the various spacecraft and telescopes that are sort of being our robotic eyes and ears out in the universe and the solar system. And we see our sort of concept of the night sky and the wider universe as we depict it in art and entertainment changing as well. It's not an austere black and white place anymore, but it's a place of vivid color. You sort of see it most prominently, I suppose, in the works of science fiction in the cinema these days, that space now is depicted as is all colorful nebulae, rather than just large voids of black and the occasional pockmark of stars that are on there. So it's a fascinating moment to sort of reflect, I think, on how we've changed our relationship with the night sky throughout all of history, in fact.
I think that's a really nice way of describing it, as an evolving relationship rather than one which has maybe become retrograde or gone backwards, or that this is a nice way to put it. And it really fits within this idea that you have in the book of charting this, kind of relationship as it is through all these various moments in history, and seeing what people look for, from, Van Gogh looking at the starry night as a way of solace to cure him after his loss of religious faith, or maybe even the Dominican friar. I was interested in this story of Giordano Bruno, I think, if I can summon up a bit of Italian, who was a bit too curious about it and ended up being burned by the Inquisition for this idea that there might be life out there. And it's it becomes a kind of unifying force, doesn't it, the night sky, then? Because you know that, and this is right at the start of your book, you know that this is exactly the same image that's presented before people in deep history, you know, beyond the
records. Absolutely. The emotional feeling that you have, I think, is the same for everybody. So again, it's using this concept of being beneath the night and looking at the stars in awe, and using that as an empathizing force across all of humankind, both living and now long, long dead.
That's a really, really nice setup. But of course, what we're going to do is, as ever, follow the Travel Through Time podcast, where we limit you to a moment or a few moments in history in a particular year. So let me start off by asking you this question, which I put to everyone who comes on. If you could travel back through time, which year would you like to visit?
Yeah, this was so difficult. I mean, so difficult.
I hope you spent days and days pondering.
Pretty much, actually. And my initial thought was to go somewhere into deep time, because there's just so many unanswered questions. And then in the end, I plumped for 1957. And one of the things that's very interesting to me about that time period is that it's in the aftermath of the Second World War. There is massive technological progress that is happening, and, you know, extraordinary forces of nature have been harnessed in the atomic bombs and the hydrogen bombs. And there is a real feeling, I think, that we are on a sort of knife edge with technology, that it, you know, we have to keep control of it. It's capable, you know, we have harnessed extraordinary power. And some people would even say, you know, we've harnessed the power of the stars themselves. So the fusion that takes place in a hydrogen bomb to give the extraordinarily large explosion, that's the same process that keeps the stars shining for eons in the night sky. And here we have brought this cosmic force down to Earth, and it's a force that's so large that, of course, people are seeing that it can lead to destruction of humankind completely.
Well, I was just thinking that you've made me reflect, I suppose, on the fact that science, for so much of the history that preceded that, was seen as a very positive force that was improving society in so many ways. But I think people have just been scared half to death by the prospect of what it can do. So that description of yours that of being on a knife edge is actually quite a provoking one.
Absolutely. And I think, whereas in the First World War, the science of chemistry was the thing that gave us the bad things, the mustard gas, the poison gas, and all those kinds of things. Now in the Second World War, it's physics that's done it. And so suddenly a perception of sort of science as a benign force of knowledge gathering is being challenged in the most in the strongest way it possibly can. And I'm not really sure that scientists of that era were equipped to defend science and the use of it, or had sort of considered these wider implications, and so it becomes a difficult time to be a scientist, to be studying science, and yet at the same time there's still a huge optimism for the technological future of the Earth in the 1950s. This idea that through technology we can lead easier, more fulfilling lives, and perhaps do these extraordinary things, harness these powers to do extraordinary things, like explore space.
And I wanted to ask you at this point, because there's something I had never heard of before, but which is an important catalytic thing in the story that we're going to follow through, which is the fact that 1957 was chosen as the International Geophysical Year. Could you tell us what that meant, please?
Yes, of course. So this was a great, it was designed to be a kind of great healing moment, really, and a coming together of scientists from across the world to study the Earth as a whole thing. So to try to understand how the planet Earth works, as it were. What are the physical processes that are going on? Can we look at it as a whole thing and study it as a system, a self-contained system, to grasp better knowledge of our home and, you know, what makes it habitable, what keeps it clement. And so it's got a, although it comes from a sort of physics side of things, the geophysical year, it does have nascent environmentalism in it, which is fascinating for where we see we'll go with space exploration and what that sort of tells us.
Perfect. So the International Geophysical Year is on, well, it's in process. Where would you like to go to for your first scene, please?
So my first scene is very specific, and it's the 4th of October in 1957, and it's onto the Kazakh steppes in Kazakhstan, specifically to a place that we now know as the Baikonur Cosmodrome. And it is here that a group of Russian rocket scientists are preparing for what will become the launch of the very first satellite into space. And that satellite is Sputnik 1.
Wow, there's quite a lot to unpack here. I think we're quite familiar with the vision of a launch nowadays. Usually they take place in Florida and there's, you know, etc. How different to that picture that we have in our contemporary minds is what's going on here in Kazakhstan? Is it a bit more of a smaller affair, do you know?
Yes, it's a bit smaller, it's a little more touchy-feely, it's you know, it's like a group of engineers in a pretty desolate place, actually, that have been building ever larger rockets, launching them into the sky, and, you know, most of them have fallen and crashed and burnt back to the Earth. And that's just the way they did things. They were engineers from the build it, test it, learn from it school. So this idea that we have nowadays of all our computer modeling and things being flown inside computers first and then launches, you know, almost going always to plan, you know, that's not what's happening here. This is real engineering.
Yeah. And of these engineers, there's one character we have to look at in particular who's called Korolev. Can you tell us about him? Because he seems to be the chief actor in this scene.
He is. So Sergei Korolev, he was so important to the Soviets that they would only refer to him in documents as the chief designer. No one knew his name until after he died because they were afraid of Western assassination attempts.
Fascinating.
And Korolev just drove this Soviet space program, trying to get a satellite into orbit. And the reason the geophysical year is important is because it was a stated aim of America that they would launch a satellite to look at the Earth from space. So this was going to be the crowning glory of this study, this scientific study, that this would be the first time that we would be able to see our planet from above and see it as a celestial object in its own right.
Which is such an exciting prospect. And Korolev.
Yes. Korolev thought that this was something that the Soviet Union should claim for itself. And these rockets that were being used by both the Americans and the Russians, these were the same rockets that had been designed to carry the nuclear missiles, the intercontinental ballistic missiles, and rain destruction down on each other, you know, across from across the world. So they were being repurposed here for scientific means and propaganda means and technological supremacy, bragging rights, as it were.
It's really interesting to see this interplay between the military and the exploration aspects of these rockets.
Korolev and his team arrived at the abandoned V2 sites and sort of retro-engineered the rockets that they found and worked out and learnt from them to see what they could use, and then transported these ideas and the techniques in to augment their own ideas and techniques to start their rocketry program back in the Soviet Union.
It's fascinating to see that through line from 1944-45 to 1957. But I suppose in his own right, I mean, this is unfair to say that this is just German technology that's been repackaged by the Russians. This Korolev is a very, very skilled engineer, isn't he?
Yes, absolutely. He's. I mean, I would put him at genius level, really, in terms of engineering and vision. It's no spoiler to say that you know, the Russians may have launched the first satellite into space, but they didn't get to the moon first. That was American. And I think my gut instinct and feeling is that if Korolev hadn't died prematurely, it would have been the Russians on the moon first, because he had such a clear vision of how to do it, how to build bigger and bigger rockets and make this happen. And so there was a sort of a leadership void when he died in the 1960s that no one really filled, and the Americans
so intriguing. That's so intriguing. But if we go back to this day on the 4th of October when Sputnik 1 is there in Kazakhstan, would Korolev have been there, or would he have watched from afar? And can you tell us
would have. Yeah, so he would have been there. And so, you know, they would have been up by the rocket, getting it all ready, standing on the launch pad there. There's a really interesting image that the Americans had taken with one of their very high altitude spy planes, where they found the launch site. And you can see there the launch tower, very similar to the way we'd think of a launch tower today, that the rocket is placed against. They've dug out the great big fire pit and the flame guard, so that the exhaust can be channeled away in a safe direction. So it's very similar, really, to a launch site architecture today, but it's much more sort of early and primitive.
Was it a successful launch?
This launch was successful. So when the rocket went up, then the team are in the bunker. And they're listening, they're getting radio signals back from the rocket. And what they see is that the rocket it's going okay, but it's not firing quite as efficiently as they hoped it would. And they're going to lose the signal very soon after launch as the rocket goes over the horizon. And so they can't see the radio signal. And Korolev decided that they were going to wait for the approximately 90 minutes or so for the satellite Sputnik 1 to come round the whole Earth and complete an orbit and sort of rise above the opposite horizon. Because he knows that if they can pick up the signal, the bleep bleep of the satellite, and that's all that Sputnik 1 did, so that they could try and win this race. They didn't put a scientific satellite up into orbit, which had been their first idea. They just put a radio transmitter up there. And so they're waiting in the bunker. They've watched the rocket fly up into the heavens, and now they're waiting to see if it reappears over the horizon.
Was an hour and a half, you say? That must have been so tense, my goodness.
That must have been so tense. And the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, He's waiting in Kiev, is actually where he is, and he's been hosting this dinner party or attending this dinner party at the Marinsky Palace, and he's keeping everybody up. It's about 11 p.m., getting later into the night. Everyone's very tired after dinner, but Khrushchev is not moving, and so nobody else is moving because he's waiting for a call which he thought would have come in an hour or more earlier. So Korolev is waiting, and then suddenly the transmitter in the bunker bleeps back into life, and there's a signal from the satellite. It's not in the highest orbit that they wanted it to get to, but it is in orbit, and it's going to circle the Earth now for a good number of weeks. Wow. So Korolev phones Khrushchev, and Khrushchev takes the call. He goes out, an aide comes and gets him, goes and takes the call. He comes back into the dinner party, and he says the Soviet Union has just launched the first artificial satellite around the Earth. And Khrushchev's son, in his memoirs, remembered that his father looked triumphant as he announced this. And everyone else just smiled politely because they had no idea of the importance of what had just happened.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm sitting here with a big smile on my face because it's a huge moment in human history. In fact, there was a launch a few months ago that I watched with my little boy, and we watched it together on the television from our, you know, they were in Florida. And I remember they interviewed someone who'd been there and watched this launch. I think it was one of the news correspondents who'd never seen anything like this before. And they were kind of lost for words because it was almost that they'd just seen something transcendental. It was something that, you know, defied all laws of reality as we understand them. So to imagine what it must have been like for Korolev and his team there, having, you know, been the first to do this.
It's just extraordinary. Your story reminds me of a lovely moment at the height of the Apollo moon program, launching these enormous Saturn V rockets to take astronauts to the moon, and those launches became sort of lightning rods, really, for the civil rights movement and people asking, why are we spending money to put white people on the moon? And there was a demonstration and a protest of black people marching on Cape Canaveral in Florida to protest against the rampant inequality in society and this sort of wanton use of money when there was so much else that needed to be fixed. And after he'd made his point, political point, the leader of this protest was asked whether he'd seen the rocket launch. And he said, yes, he had. And it had been the most spectacular thing he had ever seen in his life. So it is this super interesting thing of this idea that we have of doing something extraordinary like this and touching the night sky, this sort of going into space, sending people up there. You know, it's kind of more than that, I've come to realize with writing this book, because we're actually touching the night sky, which has been seen as the ultimate removed realm from us for most of human history, and yet, you know, we are the sort of the people at this time in history that can now do this in the rest of his life.
Well, to be there with him at that moment of maximum accomplishment, because there can only be one first, can't there? And he's got the first rocket in space, Sputnik 1. Right, okay, let's go to your second scene. Where would you like to go to next, please?
So it's a few days later, and it's in West Virginia. And it's to be standing next to a gentleman called Homer Hickam, who was a young boy at this moment, but he grew up to be a NASA engineer. And the reason for choosing him is that he had an epiphany, almost, I think, a bit like the epiphany that I had on sighting Spring Mountain, when he was standing underneath the night sky and saw Sputnik 1 cross the sky.
So where do we start? There's so many ways we can go, but I think there's a little bit we should fill in before we get to Homer Hickam and his character. I want to ask you a few questions first, and they're probably quite obvious ones, because if Khrushchev has found out about this, the launch of Sputnik has been a success, the news has got to break internationally, hasn't it? And what happens? Can you just say what happens in the immediate aftermath of the launch?
Yes, this is really interesting, because the Soviet Union sort of play it down. They announce it, but not in a really triumphalist way or anything like that. It's just
they're kind of casual. We've just put it a really rocket.
It's just like, yeah, it's just what we do. Yeah. You know,
Wednesday as well. Yeah,
no biggie. And of course, the rest of the world goes crazy for it. This is just huge, huge news, and it's right at this moment. You know, the term space age is actually coined right there and then, about we've entered the space age. And it comes, to some people, it comes as a very inspiring thing. And to others, it's horrifying. And mainly from a political point of view, because if you can now overfly any territory on Earth almost, you know, within a space of 90 minutes, you know, what does that do for national security and all these kinds of things? So it just explodes in the media, and then the Soviet media sort of picks it up and is much more vociferous about the achievement and what it means.
Okay, and so my second question is still related to Sputnik, and it's obviously what Homer Hickam is looking at in the second scene as we're with him. I think we're used to this idea of watching the International Space Station go over. In fact, my phone beeps occasionally and tells me that it's going overhead. But obviously, this would be something completely novel at that point. How easy was it to see? Was it the kind of thing that you could just go out in your garden and look up at?
Yeah, so this is... Yes, it was, in fact. Now, this is another piece of Korolev's genius. So, and to set the scene... It's sort of worth just reiterating that the night sky doesn't change. You know, the constellations that we see change with the seasons, and then the naked eye planets, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter and Saturn, you know, they make their stately way through the constellations, the zodiacal constellations. And so if you're very patient, you can watch them moving sort of week after week. But nothing really flashes through the night sky or changes about it, apart from the odd meteor shower or the appearance of a comet or something like that. So this realm was a serene place of unchanging patterns that have lasted for eons. You know, if we go back to prehistory and look up at the night sky, you know, with the sort of human ancestors, the patterns of the constellations will be somewhat deformed and changed because of the way the stars gradually move through space, but we'll still recognize them. So here was a moment on which you could actually see something, you know, moving across the sky from horizon to horizon in a matter of minutes. And the initial idea was that the radio transmitter that Korolev put onto Sputnik 1 would just send out a beep, beep. And so anyone could tune in with their radio and listen to this signal coming from space. They'd hear it increase in volume as it came above one horizon and then decrease to nothing as it went down over the opposite horizon. Korolev, however, also realized, although the Sputnik 1 satellite itself, which wasn't even a meter across, it was about half that, was going to be extremely faint, the larger upper stage of the rocket, 4 meters or so, that would reflect sunlight and be quite bright from the Earth. So to ensure that it was the brightest it could possibly be, he had his engineers install reflective panels all over it so it would be as bright as possible. And that's what people saw, Homer Hickam included, rather than the actual satellite itself. But it was just emblematic, and people just said they'd seen the Sputnik as it came overhead. It is a way of marking it as a moment in history and making it accessible to everyone who wants to see it. I think that's the point for me that, I think is so important about what Korolev did here, is it was something that could be seen, interpreted, and discussed by everyone on the flight path.
Exactly, but particular Homer Hickam. So, what does he say? Because I think he actually records his response to the site, doesn't he?
Yes, and I've chosen this. He wrote this in his memoir, a book called Rocket Boys. And I chose this moment because I think it's emblematic of what a lot of people were thinking. So he writes, "I stared at it with no less attention than if it had been God himself in a golden chariot riding overhead. It soared with what seemed to me inexorable and dangerous purpose, as if there were no power in the universe that could stop it." He's got it absolutely spot on. When I was researching this book, this was an initially a little bit of a, well, it's a big surprise to me about how much work the sort of 18th century philosophers did, and the poets of the time, in trying to make a new scientific understanding of the universe, to bring it into a human sphere of understanding, if you like, something that wasn't just confined to mathematicians and people like that. And through these ideas of the sublime, it seemed to be that the wider universe, the night sky, this is the poster child for the sublime experience, as it were. And it was so interesting to me that in that passage, Homer Hickam just lands on it straight away, this inexorable and dangerous purpose, this thing, space and now rocketry, that's so powerful and so indifferent to us that we cannot help but be somehow, in servitude or enthrall or to it. We can't hold it, we can't contain it, we can just be within it.
He's definitely feeling quite a lot of cognitive dissonance there, isn't he? Because I suppose he's just so excited. And you write as well really nicely about the political context as well of this. So at the same time, you've got the New York Herald Tribune calling it a grave defeat for America in the battle between communism and capitalism, which is being played out in the night sky. It reminds me, I suppose you were talking about the 18th century a few minutes ago, and they do have a kind of practice run for the space age in a way, because they have the hot air balloons which take people up into the clouds for the first time. And there's lots of I suppose parallels in the way that people respond to the disturbing nature of that, like the sense that we're not actually supposed to be up there, there's something fundamentally wrong with what they're doing. And you have Wordsworth writing, there's a lovely start to Peter Bell, I know, when he, it's one of his poems, and he says, "There's something in a flying horse, there's something in a huge balloon, but through the clouds I'll never float until I have a little boat shaped like the crescent moon." And it's a wonderful opening to this poem of this person, like, doing something a little bit devilish, but doing something quite exciting at the same time. And I think that's what you're expressing completely here with Homer. But I think what I also wanted to ask you about, because we're so used to, especially from our Western-centric perspective of the space age, thinking of it really being a time of American triumph because they got to the moon first, all those great Apollo missions that went on. And really, that's not the story of 1957, is it at all?
No, absolutely not. This is the story of sort of Western hubris run aground, really. And the concept of American manifest destiny and the frontier spirit and the artists of the 19th century that created those, I mean, just extraordinary works of art of the, you know, the American West, and conjured in imagery the sort of sublime and awesome landscapes. And there's this wonderful artist called Chesley Bonestell, who's working in the 1950s as well. And he's a photorealistic artist. So he's worked on paintings for backdrops in Hollywood, the Hunchback of Notre Dame, films like this. He's worked for construction companies trying to raise money. So he's painted the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, as it will be, as they hope to build it, things like that. He's also an amateur astronomer. So what he decides to do is paint what he believes to be photorealistic images of the solar system, what Saturn would look like if he was standing on one of its moons, what the moon would look like if you happened to go there. And he translates all the paintings of the American West and the style of these awesome landscapes into this sort of space, outer space realm. And so I believe that the American people felt that space was theirs. That was their manifest destiny to explore space. And so when the Russians started to have success after success after success, first satellite, first person, and all of these kinds of achievements, it was a big, big blow to them.
And of course, there's Project Vanguard, which happens pretty much simultaneously, which happened, it kind of ends in a big fireball at the launch site, doesn't it? Which is the American equivalent to Sputnik.
Yes, absolutely. So they sort of rush Vanguard onto the launch pad in order to try and just a month later get something up into the air. And it just and they get all the television cameras there so they can transmit it all live, and of course it just goes completely wrong. I think it gets about a meter off the ground before it sort of falls backwards.
So the phone call to Eisenhower isn't going to be quite as cheerful as the one to Khrushchev. Hello, it's Peter here. A few weeks ago, during our episode on Fidel Castro at the UN in 1960, you might remember that I told you about Jordan Lloyd's set of colorized images on the March to Washington. Well, it's a set of images that's full of narrative power and political significance at the moment, and it's been really great to see it take off on social media over the past week. The set has been liked on Twitter an extraordinary 220,000 times. And if you want to see these fascinating pictures too, then we'll include a link on this episode page. Jordan has also been crafting some superb images on the Beatles, on Castro, on Oscar Wilde for us here at Travels Through Time. This week, we're really lucky to have another. It's from the NASA archive in the 1950s, and it shows a very Blade Runner-ish view with huge machines and sodium lights at the wind tunnel at Langley Aeronautical Laboratory in Virginia. To be in with a chance of winning a print of this image, along with a copy of Stuart Clarke's Beneath the Night, all you need to do is head to our website at tttpodcast.com and sign up to our mailing list. Once you're on the list, you are in the hat. Full details of the prize are available on our episode page. Good luck to you. We've got one more scene. I really want to get this in, and we've got time left yet. So where shall we go from that? We'll leave Homer Hickam watching.
Again, this was a really difficult one to decide. I had a couple of people's offices that I would have quite liked to have been in. Eventually, I plumped for the American journalist Alexander Marshak. And in the aftermath of the launch, he tried to put everything together and make sense of why human beings wanted to travel into space and to touch the night sky. And the journey that begins that day for him, I think is utterly fascinating and that is still influencing scholars today.
So tell us a little bit more about Alexander. I think that's probably the best place to begin.
He's a journalist. He's a distinguished journalist. He's forever going to be remembered, however, as this journalist who started work on a book about why human beings wanted to explore space and ended up becoming an archaeologist with no formal training and having such an influence on archaeology that he sparked a discipline that we call archaeoastronomy, and which today has merged with anthropology to form cultural astronomy and the investigation of our enduring fascination with the night sky throughout all of human history.
So it's an enormous project. And if we think of him in the context of these Sputnik launches in 1957, is this process underway already, or is it in kind of genesis at that point?
I think it sparked at that moment in him this
Okay.
interest. So, as so many other people at that time, he was captivated by this launch and by the realization that space was now a realm open to human exploration. And he started to do articles and to interview people. And sort of being the journalist that he was, he didn't take it for granted that this was an inevitability. He wanted to understand why the people that were doing this wanted to explore space. What was the motivation behind it? And this is where it becomes particularly fascinating, is because it wasn't as if anyone could say why they wanted to do it. There was no fixed goal that they had. It was almost as if the interest was just primal in some way.
I know
That it was.
you mentioned George Mallory's response to why he wanted to climb Everest, and he says it's because it's there.
Yeah.
It kind of captures it almost as well as anything, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And Kennedy even uses that quote when he gives his famous speech in Houston at the Rice Stadium, saying that America is going to go to the moon by the end of the decade, and they're going to land on the moon because it's there. And so Marshak realizes, you see, that it's just somehow in people to have this fascination with the night sky, and therefore to try to touch it in this way is sort of like it's like a no-brainer kind of thing. So he changes his line of investigation, and he says, well, if nobody that's working in this field today can explain why they want to do it, then it must have come from tradition. And so he starts looking back in history to see where this tradition might have come from, where this fascination and this attraction to the night sky came from.
And this is archaeoastronomy. This is what it
And
becomes.
this is what it becomes. And he gets all the way back through to before written records. So the first writings that you find, the Sumerian texts, things like that, they're talking about the heavens and why the night sky is up there, how it's a mirror of what happens on the earth down here. So it's deeply ingrained in humankind. And Marshak believes that that some of these artifacts, these prehistoric artifacts that are not widely studied at this time, so these are things like bones or bits of fossilized wood or things like that, that seem to have tally marks on them, so notches that don't appear to be art, and yet they're on there for a reason. He starts to wonder whether those are the first primitive forms of charting the passage of time by, say, counting the phases of the moon or something like that.
Which is it's kind of nice to think about this process being kind of set in motion by the 1957 Sputnik launches, because to us, I suppose we'd think about them immediately as them pointing the way to the future, where in fact they are actually the prism through which Alexander Marshak goes right back into the past.
One of the biggest mysteries that we can look up into the night sky and feel the same fascination as our ancestors from tens, if Marshak's right, maybe even 100,000 years ago. It's quite extraordinary.
It is absolutely. I mean, you write, I think, about the various ways in which they are using the night sky, and some of it's quite practical, isn't it, as a kind of celestial clock, and then other things are about, like kind of maybe more ceremonial.
We notice that time can be marked out by the movement of the celestial objects. Day and night is obviously linked to the sun and its movement through the sky. The month is linked to the moon and the lunar phases that it goes through. And then the year is linked to the appearance of the different constellations with the seasons. And I think it's that coincidence, the fact that the way we move through space shows us different constellations at different times throughout the year, which appear to be the heralds of seasons. That's both a practical link there, and it also begs explanation. And I think as people try to explain that, that's where we see a lot of these ideas of early astrology and forces from the planets and the night sky influencing the conditions on the Earth.
Is this discipline of archaeoastronomy kind of sets out to answer just those questions. I wanted to ask probably a final question about where that discipline is today from this origin moment in the office of Alexander Marshak
Yes,
in
it's fascinating.
1957.
People that study this subject have tried to integrate more and more anthropology with the archaeoastronomy to try and see what culture, society, and the people were like in those days in order to come to a better understanding of how they, in their unique environments and with their unique outlooks, would have related to the night sky. And so
That's
this
brilliant.
is, yes, and this is what's now called cultural astronomy. And it's through that prism that people are now looking.
Well, it all starts, as it did for me in New Zealand and you in Australia, by looking up, I suppose. That's the thing that unites it all. It's a wonderful story. I've enjoyed this immensely. I'm sure that's come across. But I've got one final question I want to ask you before we leave this very, very invigorating, enlightening history. If you could bring one object back to have as a talisman or a memento from 1957, maybe to get you out of bed a bit quicker in the morning or to get you more excited when you're sitting down at your writing desk, what would you like to have?
Yeah, so I thought about this one as well. So what I decided I would do is that I would sit with Korolev as he's waiting by the radio receiver in Baikonur. And then when he went off to make his phone call to Khrushchev, I'd nick the radio receiver. The human piece of equipment that received the first signal from space.
Transmission.
Yeah.
Wow, what an object. Really, really, really enjoyed this, as I said before. The book's called Beneath the Night, if you want to go and find out the story in much more detail. And I really think you should, because you've captured a lot of the wonder, a lot of the awe, and so many wonderful stories at the same time. Stuart Clark, thank you very, very much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's been a real pleasure.
That was me, Peter Moore, talking to Stuart Clark about 1957 and Stuart's new book, which is called Beneath the Night. It's recently been published in hardback by Faber, and as you heard in the interview, it's a book full of little wonders. To find out much more about this episode, please do head to our website, which is tttpodcast.com. There you can read more about the scenes and the characters. You can view that striking colorized image from NASA by Jordan Lloyd of Colourgraph, and I'm going to put up my own picture of the night sky that I described. It's the one taken in New Zealand a few years ago. If you enjoyed all of this, you can also find Cassius St. Clair's episode on our website as well. That tells the story of how the Apollo 11 spacesuits were made. That's a really fascinating story. We'll be back with another episode next Tuesday, but from me for now, that's it. Thank you very much for listening.